You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
Indeed.
So we have quite a bit to get to today, but I do want to begin on a fairly somber note. Melissa, just some heartbreaking news earlier this week about Idaho's first confirmed pediatric COVID death. I mean, this was something I don't think any of us wanted to have to see or report on.
It's something I know that myself and other reporters have been dreading news of this. Earlier this week, the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare confirmed the first pediatric death in an infant younger than a year old, lived in Southwest Idaho. We don't know very many other details because the health department wanted to protect the family's privacy. We do know that while thankfully serious cases among pediatric patients are rare, they are not non-existent. You know, we do know that there have been nearly 40 children who have been hospitalized with multi-symptom inflammatory syndrome in children. We know that toddlers and teenagers alike have been hospitalized with very serious COVID infections. And so we also know that there have been two stillbirths recorded in at least two recorded in which COVID infection in the mother was listed as a cause of that stillbirth. And so it's devastating news. And it's one that a lot of us had been dreading throughout the course of this pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should note that we do know now at least you can get your child vaccinated down to 5 years old. So hopefully that will at least help with some of this. I want to turn to some other news now. So Betsy, last Friday on our reporter roundtable, we talked about the governor Brad Little, being out of state, not telling the lieutenant governor about it. She got upset about that. Now we find out that they both were in Florida. Get us updated from there and who's endorsing whom these days.
Oh, yes. It was quite an eventful week last week on the Brad and Janice front. The governor went to former President Trump's gala for his policy institute. His America First Policy Institute was invited, attended, and posted a photo of himself in a tuxedo being recognized by former President Trump and applauded at the gala. The lieutenant governor said that she had also gone to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump and had a personal meeting with him on Tuesday. The gala was on Thursday. She was very upset that the governor had left without telling her. And their ongoing dispute about when she is entitled to serve as acting governor and when she is not. It took me quite a while to piece together the overlapping schedules for these two trips to Florida to figure out what time frame we were talking about. It was a little over a day, it looks like, when their schedules did overlap in that the governor had returned from Florida. The governor had not yet returned from Florida, but the lieutenant governor had, because she posted something on Facebook from her transmission shop in Idaho Falls, noting that she was back in Idaho. And so her contention is that for that time period, she not only should have been empowered to serve as acting governor, but perhaps to have been paid. She's put in some inquiries to see if about differential pay. And of course, this is an ongoing dispute between the governor and lieutenant governor as to, under the Idaho Constitution, when the governor has to hand over power to be acting governor to somebody else. And the lieutenant governor is first in the line of succession, followed by the Senate president pro tem, and then the Speaker of the House. And in the past, that's typically been whenever the governor's left the state. But according to an Idaho attorney general's opinion, the precedents are split in other states on this. Courts have interpreted it as when the governor is effectively absent from the state, in other words, can't carry out duties even by phone or virtually. But they've been split right down the middle on which way they've gone. And so the two have taken different interpretations, and it hasn't yet gone to court. So we don't know what the result is. However, it appears that the result of both these trips to Florida was favorable for the lieutenant governor, Janice McGeehan, as President Trump announced late last week, the former President Trump, that he is endorsing McGeehan to be the next governor of Idaho over Little, whom she is challenging in the Republican primary this May. Governor Little, of course, hasn't yet announced his reelection plans, but he has been actively fundraising and has made it pretty clear he's probably running.
All right. A lot to unpack there, Betsy, with that. Just so much, just so much. Clark, we've also in the past talked about former state representative Aaron Von Elliger. He has been accused of rape. In fact, has had some court appearances. What is the latest with that?
Yeah, Gemma, he had his arraignment on Monday in Ada County. That was a very quick hearing. It was conducted remotely, virtually over Zoom. And he pleaded not guilty to the two felony charges that he's facing, which are charges of rape and forcible penetration with a foreign object. It was a very short arraignment. He pleaded not guilty. And then the judge set a jury trial for beginning in April 2022. I think setting aside 4 or 5 days for a jury trial that would begin next April. It was a real quick court hearing. Former Representative Von Elliger spoke very little, very briefly. He said he understood the charges. He said he understood Idaho statutes, and he understood the potential penalties if he's convicted. But beyond that, really just entering not guilty pleas, sort of as expected. And then the judge did set the date. There's going to be a jury trial, like I said, and coming up in late April. And so that will be when things really pick up again and when it goes to trial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Don, you just reported on this the other day. Some major changes coming to Brundage Mountain up in McCall.
Yeah, you know, Brundage Mountain, they like to quote Skiing Magazine, which said that they are the last great place, and there will be changes to that last great place. About a year ago, we reported that a group of local folks, led by Bob Looper, was going to acquire the result from the longtime owners, led by Judd DeBoer, who passed away in the spring of 2020. And now they're out with their plan for what they want to do. And in the first few phases here, what you're going to see if this gets approved by Adams County, where Brundage sits, just over the line from Valley County and the Forest Service, is a new lodge. I'm a pretty frequent Brundage terrible skier, and it's the lodge up there has seen better days. It's huge. It's a big lodge, but it's definitely showing its age. So Looper and the investment group hope to work through a multi-phase plan to build a new lodge that would go right along the snow front there, where the parking lot meets the snow, and then eventually remove the old lodge. And maybe we'll see a condominium hotel on the mountain. Hmm. There's also going to be a number of home sites for sale. And this has come up with a couple of projects that we've reported on this week, where residential sales often help fund other types of improvements like the new lodge. But Looper stresses that they're really trying to keep the essence of what Brundage Mountain is. And they brought in a number of outside consultants, many of which said, hey, you've got this great flat parking lot. Let's build this big fancy village. And Looper said, yeah, we don't want to do that, because one of the things that people love about Brundage is you drive up the hill, you park your car, you throw your skis on your shoulder or your snowboard over your back, and you walk to the lift, and you're on the slopes in 5 minutes or less. And they want to protect that. There's also some additional skiable terrain and new lifts coming in the future. They didn't elaborate fully on what those would look like, but some really big changes. And just the lodge alone will be a $10 million investment. And you know, the reaction this week has been mixed, both folks in Valley County and here in the Treasure Valley. But honestly, I haven't posted about a new project in a couple of years where the reaction isn't mixed. So people are always going to have differing opinions. Some people are worried that they could see changes to the character of Brundage, and some people are excited to see some upgrades. So definitely big news at Brundage Mountain. Ground would be broken this spring. Next ski season would probably be a little dicey as they work through it. And then the following season, so not this one, not the next one, but the one after, you'll see that new lodge and some of those improvements open up at Brundage.
Well, and I do think it's interesting, Don, to say that it's, I mean, mixed, of course, but I mean, Brundage has kind of been that smaller ski, you know, ski mountain, accessible, as you mentioned. I mean, quick to get to, you know, more affordable than most. And you can see why there might be some mixed feelings about, frankly, adding it and making it bigger and fancier.
For sure. And, you know, Brundage Mountain was owned jointly by J.R. Simplot and the DeBoers for a long time, founded in the early 60s. And it always has been kind of that, like, Idaho secret. It's not Sun Valley. It's not even Tamarack. And frankly, it's different than what's happening at Bogus. But I had a fairly long, my reporter Autumn Robertson actually did this story, but because of scheduling, I talked to Bob Luber myself for the interview. And the thing that he really stressed is they don't want to screw this up. You know, they think there are some improvements that need to be made, but they want to keep the essence of what that is. And, you know, he said, boy, I hope people, when they see this first phase of residential, they'll really be pleased, and essentially it'll build up some trust. So they know that tension is there. You know, Luper was one of the folks who was opposed to the Trident Holdings proposal for to do development in much of the land around McCall that is now currently not happening. And I asked him, I said, hey, you know, are we going to see homes at the top of the hill on Brundage that you'd be able to see from McCall? And he said, no, these home sites are going to be around the base area. So, you know, I try and take people at face value on what they say.
Yeah.
And what he's saying is, we don't want to screw this up. There are going to be some changes, but we want to keep it that Idaho classic, quote, last great place type of place.
A lot to get to in regards to the upcoming special legislative session. Clark, why don't you kick us off with this? Why are they having this session? When does it start?
Yeah, thanks, Jimma. I think a lot of people have these questions about why we're reconvening. And at this point, it's not a surprise that they're reconvening, but we took a very convoluted road to get here. Kind of took the scenic route. Just some quick context real fast. Back in May, the Idaho Senate adjourned the legislative session for the Senate for the year after the longest legislative session in Idaho history, 122 long days. That same day, however, the Idaho House voted down a motion to adjourn and instead adopted a resolution to go at an extended recess, subject to the call of Speaker of the House Scott Bedke, due to return no later than December 31st. And so House Republicans did that on purpose so that they would have an opportunity to come back into session. Normally, the Idaho Constitution makes it so that only the governor may call a special session. Governor Brad Little has not called a special session, but Republicans in the Idaho House view this as they're just reconvening the existing session, coming back from recess. And so there is a little bit of uncertainty. I think senators, particularly Senate Democrats, feel very differently about where things stand than House Republicans. But it is starting Monday morning. The Idaho House and Idaho Senate are scheduled to convene at 9 a.m. We may see the House Ways and Means Committee meet even sooner than that, even earlier on Monday morning, to consider what Idaho Education News has reported could be up to 32 draft bills waiting for legislators when they arrive on Monday. I think the big themes, there's really two things that we expect to happen. We expect Republicans in the House to create a response to President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine rules for large employers. We also expect the House to take up an ethics complaint filed against Representative Priscilla Giddings, a Republican from Whitebird. She has been, there was a complaint filed and an ethics committee voted unanimously to recommend the legislature censure her for conduct unbecoming of a legislator for essentially posting a blog that included the photo and the name of a teenage legislative intern who accused former Representative Aaron Von Ellinger of rape. We talked a few minutes ago before the break about mm-hmm. former Representative Von Ellinger pleading not guilty on Monday. This ethics complaint stems from the fact that Representative Giddings posted a blog that publicly identified, included a photo of this 19-year-old intern who accused Representative Aaron Von Ellinger of rape. And so those are the two things that we expect to be considered, but it's going to be just wild. I know Betsy and Melissa have been reporting on this, but I'm hearing everything from we could be there 3 days to quite a bit longer than 3 days to, oh no, maybe there'll be a motion to adjourn immediately when we get there on Monday. So I think kind of buckle up and and it's going to be maybe a wild ride. And that's sort of how the legislature always goes. But I'd be kind of curious to see maybe what Betsy has heard as we prepare to reconvene on Monday.
Yeah, Betsy, I'm very curious your thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, I just spoke to Senator Chuck Winder, the Senate President Pro Tem, and he said that the Senate, which like the House, is scheduled to convene at 9 a.m. on Monday, also is probably going to convene its Senate State Affairs Committee to print some bills or resolutions, maybe around 8 a.m. They are not looking at 32 of them. They're looking at maybe a resolution, a memorial, and a bill or two. And among the things they're considering are the creation of a $2 million legal fund to fight or push back against federal mandates. I think that the Senate is taking a little bit different approach than the House to this, but as Clark mentioned, the biggest objections thus far have come from the Senate Democrats, who actually held a press conference this morning and said that in their view, it's illegal and counter to the rules to convene the Senate next week because they adjourned sine die on May 12th, and therefore anything that they pass will be subject to challenge. Nevertheless, the Democrats are also in the Senate also proposing their own bill, and this one would require expeditious spending of federal COVID aid that we've received but haven't spent to help frontline workers, including teachers. And I did ask the Democratic leaders about, well, are you having it both ways here? And they said, well, kind of, yeah, we believe if we could get our bill passed, we'd probably have to pass it again in January to make sure it's legal. But on the other hand, if we're going to be there, we're not just going to sit on our hands. We're going to try to do something constructive. Now, over on the House side, Speaker Begke has made clear that they want to entertain legislation only on vaccine mandates. And so presumably the 32 proposed bills that have been submitted to the House Ways and Means Committee all relate to vaccine mandates. And if they don't, perhaps they won't be printed. But any that they do print and introduce, they're going to refer to other committees, and then it'll be up to those committee chairmen as to whether they hold hearings on them. So this really doesn't sound like just a three-day process. But as Clark said, all bets are off. Anything could happen. We really don't know what. The ethics issue is also a really serious issue for the House. And they are facing a unanimous recommendation from the House Ethics Committee to censure Representative Giddings and to remove her from one of her committee memberships. Her local newspaper, the Lewiston Tribune, just published something noting that in a fundraising email she sent out, she claimed that the legislature is trying to censor her rather than censure her. And noting the distinction there, that rather than trying to tell her what she can't say, they are trying to react to what was deemed to be conduct unbecoming a member of the House of Representatives through their rules that allow for sanctions in response to that.
So I'm curious. I feel like the legislature just ended because it went on so long. Not sure if I'm ready for this, But Betsy and Melissa, I mean, your take on, I mean, as you mentioned, Betsy, this, what you just laid out, this is not 3 days, but are they going to carry this out? I mean, we've got holidays coming up. I mean, will that play into it at all? Or as Clark said, is it's kind of like hold onto our hats and see what happens.
I would agree with Clark. I don't think at this point anyone knows what's going to happen on any of these matters. I do know that not a lot of people in the legislature want to be there for that law, to be sure. Whether or not that's going to turn into a full week or, you know, run into Thanksgiving, they're not going to be there on Thanksgiving, for heaven's sake. But, you know, going after, is that a possibility? I will say that I've got to plug this today on Idaho Reports. We have House Speaker Scott Bedke, Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder, and House Minority Leader Ilana Rubel. And they're going to address some of these concerns, like how much input the public will have, whether the public will be able to see the bills before the committee takes them up, if they even get that far, if they don't immediately vote to adjourn and go home.
Melissa, you're having that on Idaho Reports tonight. So for folks who are wondering where and when to watch that, give us the time.
Idaho Reports airs 8 p.m. on Fridays on Idaho Public Television. You can also catch it online after it airs at idahoptv.org.
Should be an interesting conversation, I think, Melissa, especially when we look at can the public be involved in this? Because that's a whole other issue that's come up.
Exactly. We're taping that conversation in a couple hours, and I don't know what to expect. I'm looking forward to it. And even after having this conversation, Clark has a really good point. They don't know what's going to happen either. You know, there are 105 members of the legislature, and I think it's safe to say every one of them has a different idea of how this should go.
Melissa's right, and her show is going to be interesting tonight. I talked with Representative Brooke Green, a Boise Democrat, and she said, you know, we have a regular legislative session just around the corner that's going to kick off on January 10th, and all of this can wait till then. Representative Green told me that the Idaho legislature is a part-time legislature for a good reason. They have legislative sessions for a good reason, and that is the time to address these things, that we can address these things come January. She said it's a waste of time. She said it's a waste of taxpayers' money. And she said we're going down a slippery slope if every time there's a federal mandate that some legislator disagrees with, we can't be calling ourselves back into session to address it. But she, Representative Green, and Representative Ilana Rubel, another Boise Democrat, told me this is kind of a preview because next year, come November, there's going to be a ballot question on election day about whether the Idaho legislature should be able to call itself back into session. And so this is kind of the preview this year. But the Democrats that I talked to were very upset, don't think it's appropriate to be coming back, and think that all of this can and should wait until everyone's back together under the State House Rotunda January 10th.
Well, you have the calendar starting. Go ahead, Melissa.
That said, the Republicans I've talked to have pointed out, and rightfully so, that even though some people feel like this can wait until January, there are already employees who are wondering if they are going to lose their jobs if this mandate isn't struck down in court. So for some people who fall under that category of the vaccine mandate and for whatever reason don't want to get vaccinated, or employers who are wondering how this is going to play out under these OSHA rules that aren't yet clear, they feel like it's a little bit more urgent and they don't want to wait until January.
You have some calendar collisions here. I was asked this spring to speak at the Idaho Association of Taxpayers Conference, which was billed as kind of the informal start to the legislative season to talk about growth. And that's on December 1st, and I guess it's the kickoff to the next session, but we could still be in this session. So, and then there's a whole bunch of other things that are supposed to happen in December that kind of ramp up, as all the reporters on this roundtable know way better than I do, that ramp up to the next session. So I'm kind of looking at the calendar thinking, strange times.
It's kind of like a pre-funk or a tailgate before the actual... before the actual session comes on board. All right, before we take a break, Don, I do want to switch gears because I want to talk about more apartments coming to downtown Boise. I mean, yes, we need them for sure. But I have to tell you, Don, I'm downtown almost every single day. I cannot keep up with the amount of building that is going on there. It is literally like I turn a corner and there's a new building.
Me either. And it's how I make my living. I know we're going to talk about some dynamics in the housing market next Tuesday on Idaho Matters. But yeah, we brought news first on Friday, and then we had some additional information yesterday about a project called the Saratoga. And I'll help orient you here. If you've been to downtown Boise, it's the old A1 heating and cooling right by the entrance to the connector that's been the Boise Creative Center for the last few years. Tree Fort has its main stage on an empty parking lot on this site, right there at 12th and Grove. And this is a fairly large project. What's interesting is it's not what I would call very tall. It's only, quote unquote, only seven stories, but it would take up the entire city block and add more than 300 apartment units with parking for 330 cars, some of that underground and some of that on the first floor. Also, it had some retail on Grove Street, some other pieces. So it's a different style of project than we have seen downtown, where most of the projects aren't quite this big in terms of massing, right? So you think about, if you look down from Google Earth at a city block, this would take up the whole city block and would be in kind of a donut shape. So in the middle, there would be a courtyard with a pool and barbecues and other things that the apartment dwellers like. And then the apartments would ring around that internal courtyard. There's actually a rendering up on boisedev.com of both the apartment and that site plan I'm trying to clumsily describe on the radio. But yeah, this is one of just a number. We've got about 1,000 apartment units that are in various stages of completion in downtown Boise. We have a couple of projects that are complete, some that are about to come online, and some that are a little further out. This adds another 300 to that. And it wasn't that long ago that really the only people that lived downtown were in the Idenhaw, the Idaho building, or a couple of the remaining single family homes. And that was it. Maybe the Aspen Lofts, but that was kind of it. Now we're going to have literally thousands of people living downtown, which is already starting to change the character here. And I think we'll do more so. And we've got a bunch of other projects that I'm not even mentioning here that are in various states of proposal.
Okay, we are going to talk about redistricting. And holy cow, I think this could take up the rest of the show. Clark, you have been on the program a few times talking about this. So can you just start off by giving us some background on why redistricting is taking place?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels a little bit intimidating, but it's important. And I can talk about why we're doing it and what we've done and the process. But as everybody knows, Idaho's had tremendous growth over the last 10 years. According to the 2020 census, Idaho was in fact the second fastest growing state in the country. But that growth was all divided and uneven, as Don and everybody else knows. The Treasure Valley, Western Ada County grew a tremendous amount, but other parts of the state didn't grow as fast, or in some rare cases lost ground. And so the U.S. Constitution and the Idaho Constitution requires this redistricting process every 10 years. We use the new census population data. And one of the most important goals of redistricting is to ensure that political representation is as close to equal as possible. And so what we did was, Idaho has a bipartisan redistricting commission, and it's kind of cool. It's truly bipartisan. There were three members appointed by Republicans and three members appointed by Democrats, whereas in many states, the state legislature handles redistricting. And Idaho used to do that until the early 90s. But we've got this bipartisan commission. They use the new census population data, and they're redrawing our legislative boundaries and our congressional boundaries. And so Idaho has 35 legislative districts. That's not changing. Idaho has two congressional districts, and that's not changing either. And since September 1st, these six commissioners have been working with the census data, working with this mapping software, kind of drawing up these new districts. They appeared to finish the job last Friday. They voted to approve a new congressional map and a new legislative map. And then there was some concern about whether the agenda was specific enough. And I think out of an abundance of caution, they redid the votes on Wednesday of this week, but nothing changed. They approved the same maps that they did last week. And the idea is that these maps would be in place for the next 10 years and would govern our elections for the next 10 years if they're not challenged and struck down. We did just learn about a challenge, and Betsy had a really good report about how the challenge may be premature. But it's these redistricting plans, as expected, are leading to a lot of shakeups. I think Betsy made a really good point the last time we were on, talking about something that's going to affect a lot of Idahoans, and that is they're going to find that even though they didn't move, they may be in a new legislative district. And we're starting to see political candidates, elected officials have the same issue, or even though they didn't move, they're being moved into a new legislative district. Sometimes, in some cases, brought into another legislative district that already has legislators serving in it. And so they may have to decide whether to run against each other next year or to step aside. But it's kind of a divisive, insidery political process. It took 70 days. There were all these public hearings across the state. There were 18 different public hearings. Betsy and I talked to redistricting commissioner Dan Schmidt, and he said that he borrowed his daughter's hybrid vehicle and put 6,000 miles on it this fall, driving all across the state to all these different public hearings. The maps are available online on the redistricting commission's website. And they, like I said, there's both a congressional map and a legislative map. And now we're starting to see these challenges. We saw concerns coming up towards the end of the process. The Ada County Commission wrote a letter opposed to the redistricting plan. They're concerned with how Ada County was divided up on the legislative map. Parts of Ada County have been divided up, so they're now in with Canyon County. A part of Ada County has been divided up, so now it's in with like Jim County and part of Emmett. The Shoshone-Bannock tribe has also complained about how the redistricting legislative map would split up the Fort Hall Reservation. And so it all comes down to how we divide our counties into different legislative districts. And it's a really complicated process because there's some things that can't change. We have 44 counties, that's not going to change. We have 35 legislative districts, that's not going to change because voters approved that language, I want to say last year. And so how do we divide 44 counties into 35 equally sized legislative districts without splitting up the counties? That was one of the toughest assignments for the redistricting commission this year.
So, I mean, it sounds really inside politics, right? And I can see a lot of people thinking, why does this really matter? But I think there's huge implications for this, even for voters. But Betsy Clark mentioned this idea of incumbents and how it's going to impact them, but as well as new seats. I mean, what do we know right now? I mean, because there could be some possible maybe infighting or frankly jockeying for a seat.
Well, all kinds of it. And to me, the heart of what redistricting is about protecting people's right to equal representation. And that's certainly what the commission made its top priority here. You know, that one person, one vote, just because, you know, one person, we shouldn't have people in some parts of the state who have much more representation in the legislature than others. However, the big news that comes out of redistricting is the political blood sport, in that it can completely destroy the political future of a politician to be redistricted into the same district as another strong incumbent. And there's a ton of that in this plan, as we knew there would be, because there's been so much growth and so much population change in our state. There are three districts that contain four current House incumbents in the new plan.
Wow.
There are only two House seats in each district. There are several districts that have two Senate incumbents, and there's only one in each district. And there are as many as 16 new open seats that are created by this plan. So at the same time that a lot of current legislators may have to either bow out or run against each other, there will be new opportunities in many parts of the state for people to run for the legislature in an open seat without having to go up against an incumbent. The implications for Idaho politics and for the makeup of the Idaho legislature and for everybody's representation are absolutely huge. And so the big scramble for me this week was to try to figure out what was that impact on incumbents. And it was really hard to figure out this time around because the commission is prohibited by law from considering exactly that kind of political consideration when they draw the lines. So they didn't have anything in their software, in their system, that showed where those incumbents live, which is not what the situation was in the past. And I don't, you know, they were still prohibited from considering it in the past, but this time they didn't even know, their staff didn't know, nobody knew. And it was hard to figure out because if you look at the addresses that legislators list, say in the legislative directory, some of them list their office, some list a PO box. It doesn't necessarily tell you where they live. And so finally, in a very last minute scramble after the commission voted, I was able to request a voter registration roll showing the addresses of the current incumbents. And for example, Senator Jim Rice in Caldwell ended up two blocks outside of his previous legislative district. And he is now in the same district with Senator Abby Lee. And he's not real happy about how the map came out. And there are others like that. And so I did put together a story that ran in Thursday's Idaho Press, laying out which incumbents fell into which new districts and which were the open seats. But I had a couple of errors I had to correct. So we had a correction today. For example, Senator Rice is not in two districts, as I wrongly reported in my first draft. It's Senator Lakey who falls into the same district as Senator Lodge in the new District 23. There are a whole lot of political questions that'll have to be hashed out among these incumbents. And the timing's so interesting because they're all coming back to town on Monday. Well, what are they going to be talking about? I mean, the four House members who are landed in the new District 22 are Representatives Stephen Harris, Greg Furch, John Vander Wouda, and Jason Monks. They are no doubt going to be chatting about each other's plans and how this all affects them when they come to town. And that will be an overlay, a political overlay to the business that gets conducted or not conducted next week when our legislature reconvenes as they look ahead to the election that's coming this spring.
Yeah, and Betsy, can I just say something real quick, Clark? Because Betsy, didn't you also report that there is at least one state senator that's actually going to resign, but then rerun in her new district next election?
That is correct. And that is actually not a direct result of redistricting. Senator Ali Rabi, who is a first term senator, it's interesting because her top issue has been Idaho's housing crisis. That's what she's focused all her legislative work on. And she announced that she and her fiance have been house hunting for a long time, and it's been very difficult. They finally found their dream house, and they'd been outbid many a time with cash offers, and they got the house they wanted, but it wasn't in her legislative district, her current or her new one. It was in the next one over. And so she felt compelled to resign her seat in the legislature right now, and she will run again next year in the new district that she'll land in. And it happens that the incumbent in that district, Senator Burgoyne from Boise, isn't planning to run for re-election. So that will be an open seat. Now, she may not be the only one running for that, but it's interesting that a current sitting senator will not be serving for the next year, but will be running to come back. She also plans to serve as a substitute and continue to work with legislators in her new district and her old district and all the legislators on those housing issues, including several bills that she already has drafted.
So sticking with redistricting for a moment longer, Clark and Betsy, both of you brought this up. We have elections coming up in 2022. Yes, these maps could be challenged, but if they stay the way they are, how does this change the makeup of the state legislature come 2023, but potentially for the next decade?
I think there will be huge turnover in the House, and I haven't really had a chance to evaluate what exactly that will look like. Part of it will depend on what everybody does. But when I was speaking with Representative Vander Wouda from Nampa, he personally expects half the House to turn over in next year's election. Wow. And, you know, some people might think that's a good thing. Some people might think it's a bad thing. He thinks it's a terrible thing. We'll lose all our institutional knowledge. We'll have all kinds of people coming in saying, oh, I think I have an idea to fix this, without knowing that that's been tried and it didn't work. It could be really interesting.
Yeah, I think
what are your thoughts,
right,
Clark?
I think Betsy's exactly right. It's this once a decade shakeup that we're going to have. And so we'll know a little bit more once the filing period officially opens in late February, because like Betsy pointed out, there's two House seats in each of the 35 legislative districts. And so legislators and candidates can decide whether they're going to file for House Seat A or House Seat B. We'll know more about that come February, heading into the primary, but it is going to be this huge shakeup. I agree with Betsy that the Idaho House is going to be very, very different in 2023. Redistricting is going to be a big reason why. And then the overall elections are going to be a big reason why. Right now, we have all these sitting legislators who say they're running for higher office, whether it's lieutenant governor, whether it's secretary of state on down the line. And so to run for those positions, they won't be able to run for the legislature. So I think it's reasonable that up to half the House could turn over. We also know that we're going to have a new Speaker of the House in 2023, because House Speaker Scott Bedke is running for Lieutenant Governor. If he runs for Lieutenant Governor, he can't run for the legislature. So new leadership in the House in 2023, significantly new members in 2023. We don't know exactly how it'll break down with Republicans versus Democrats. I don't expect huge changes. Obviously, the Republicans will continue to control power and will continue to control the majority in the legislature, but the individual changes will be interesting and quite a bit of turnover. I agree with Betsy.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've got like a minute and a half left. And Don, I want to wrap it up, not with politics, but with food, because the Golden Wheel may be returning.
Yep. Golden Wheel on Fairview. We reported last year, or feels like last year, this summer, that they were closing. They did so kind of quietly. People were upset. And the owner said, you know what? I'm going to adapt. And they're going to reopen. They're going to cut burgers and sandwiches from the menu. And if you've driven by Golden Wheel, they have a sign that says burgers. So I guess they'll have to take that down.
Yeah.
It helps them simplify operations and get through the employee crunch, but they'll have all the ice cream treats, and they're going to add some things like corn dogs and finger steaks, things that they can fry. And they tell me they hope to be open next week. So if you enjoyed the Golden Wheel, and I will tell you, I had one last batch of fries there when I was working on the story this summer when they closed, you'll get another chance.
Well, and it's kind of one of those institutions, Don. I mean, it's been there for so long. So I actually think it's really nice to see them coming back and kind of, you know, figuring out a new way to do this.
Yeah. And, you know, the owner said that he was inspired because the, what's the team's name? It's like the Golden Wheel Rebels. It's a football team that they sponsor and still sponsored. Went to the championship this year, and he said, you know what? They did cool big things. We're going to try and do cool big things. So the Golden Wheel Drive-In on Fairview should reopen next week.
And I want to thank all of you for being on the panel today. Big thank you to Don Day, Betsy Russell, Melissa Davlin, and Clark Corbin. I appreciate all of you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. And I want to thank all of you for joining us on this Friday. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I must say a happy birthday to my now 10-year-old Joey, Gorilla of Pain. Jojo, love you. Hey, everybody, it's Friday. Hope you have some joy in your weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.